So welcome, everybody. Welcome. So those here in the physical center at Seattle Insight, and welcome everybody at home online. Can we give you a wave? We see you. Hello. Nice. Always joyful to see everybody entering, coming in. So for those of you I haven't met, my name is Carrie, and our usual format here, in case this is your first time or you're newer to this, we'll sit for 40 minutes. So we'll offer a little bit of guidance during our sitting meditation at first, just a little bit, plenty of time for silence as well. We'll have a short break. Come back and offer a few reflections on our theme, and then we'll have time to discuss and talk about that theme and how it applies to our everyday lives. So I'll just close by reading the Mangala Sutta, part of the Mangala Sutta. So I believe Lindell read this last week. Many deities and people yearning after good have pondered on blessings. Pray, tell me the greatest blessing. So this is a being who's speaking to the Buddha. So pray, tell me the greatest blessing. The Buddha says, not to associate with the foolish, but to associate with the wise, to honor those who are worthy of honor. This is the greatest blessing. To reside in a suitable place, to have done beneficial actions in the past, and to set oneself in the right course. This is the greatest blessing. To have much learning, to be skillful in craft, well-trained in discipline, to be of good speech, this is the greatest blessing. To support mother and father, to cherish family, to be engaged in peaceful occupation, this is the greatest blessing. To be generous in giving, to be righteous in conduct, to help one's relatives, to be blameless in action, this is the greatest blessing. To abstain from harm, to refrain from intoxicants, to be steadfast in virtue, this is the greatest blessing. To be respectful, humble, contented, and grateful, and to listen to the Dhamma on occasion, this is the greatest blessing. To be patient and obedient, to associate with monastics on occasion, this is the greatest blessing. Self-restraint, a holy life, the perception of the noble truths and the realization of Nibbana, this is the greatest blessing. A mind unruffled by misfortune, from sorrow freed, from defilements, cleansed, from fear, liberated, this is the greatest blessing. Those who abide like this ever remain invincible, in happiness established. These are the greatest blessings. These are the greatest blessings. So may each of us and all beings be well in body and mind. May each of us and all beings remember we can reflect on our actions. And may each of us and all beings remember our sources of blessing, protection, peace. Okay, so how are we? How's everybody? There's no easy way of giving an answer to that question, but I like to ask. Sometimes I'll do, many of you know this, but sometimes I'll do kind of light hindrance checks, just as a way of checking in. How many people are on the more sleepy end of the spectrum tonight? Sleepy, drowsy. Yeah, those at home, you participate too. How many people are more on the kind of agitated, restless, I should have done something more active tonight side? Yeah, okay. How many people notice some deeper experience of mindful awareness being here and practicing even for a little bit? Yeah, and how about interest in your experience? Interest, curiosity, yeah. A little bit more willingness to apply effort or energy. Yeah, being in the room a little bit. Good. All right, so hindrances and awakening factors are often all in there together. But sometimes I like to just do that as a way of kind of checking in. Because it's all in there. It's all in there together, held in awareness. So most of you know that we're exploring the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and specifically this month, right or wise action. So how many people have listened to a talk this month already on right or wise action? At least one. Some? Okay, most. Great. So one kind of benefit, I think, of speaking towards the end of the week or the end of the month, is that you've likely heard a lot of words already and been practicing in your own way, most people already. So what I'd like to do is just make offer a few simple reflections and then really hear from you about what you've been noticing, especially this topic of wise action really benefits from the particulars or the specifics, right? So its kind of broadest or clearest definition is that wise action or right action is action that contributes to the well-being of ourselves and others. And unwise action is action that moves in the direction of harming oneself and or others. Right. So there are lots of permutations and explorations of that. So I'd love to hear a little bit and have people have a chance to talk together about specifics about what you've been noticing, these questions. Ethical questions are often very alive for people, you know? And I like to think of this I reflect on this often, how it's natural as practice deepens and evolves to start kind of examining one's own actions in life and asking these kind of questions. Is this in line with right action? Is this what I'm doing contributing to harm? We're asking that in deeper and deeper ways. So at under 40, the young adult group, the other week, I started by asking people, how many people have noticed since you've been practicing a greater sensitivity to suffering and harm? So I'll ask you also, how many people have noticed a greater sensitivity to suffering and harm? Yes. So it does seem to be that as the heart kind of becomes more sensitive, these questions about what is skillful, what is not, what is harmful, what is not, become more interesting and alive. The heart becomes more sensitized. The other reason I asked this question with under 40ers the other night was because many of them had just come from our yearly retreat, the annual young adult retreat at Cloud Mountain, which many people knew each other and were participating together. And we can notice, and I've reflected on this a lot over the years, that those of us who attend retreat, and I know for myself early on, very powerful experiences on retreat, and assume that primarily those powerful experiences arise because of the meditation technique that we're doing. And that is indeed a large part of it. Of course, it's the practice that we're doing. It's listening to the teachings. But also what retreat offers us is kind of enforced, right action, enforced sila or ethical conduct, right? You aren't able to decide you're going to binge on a bag of chips in the middle of the day. You can't, you're separated from all of your devices. You can't get into an argument with your partner. You are kind of forced to take what's offered. You're in an environment of silence and seclusion. So, not that you can't get into a lot of trouble and mischief on retreat, because you can, but it's kind of this enforced sila for a while. And I think we underestimate the extent to which that is also conducive to our sensitivity, to our practice, to our deepening. I've been on several Zen retreats in different traditions, and it's been so interesting because in many of them, every kind of action is prescribed, right? So you're not left, like Vipassana retreats, you're kind of left to kind of wander through the territory of your own minds often. But in a lot of Zen retreats, you walk in a certain way so that you're part of the formation of the group. You're walking in step with the person in front of you. You eat, you attend to your dishes, your bowl, your napkin. There's nothing extraneous in your move. Everything is like choreographed and attuned to what the people around you are doing. And this can feel, especially at first, kind of constricting and tight and narrowing. But in another way, it's kind of a more extreme version of kind of enforced sila, or like someone felt to me at one point, like someone taking my body and showing me what right action felt like. So that is one, that is such a wonder of retreat, to recognize that how powerful right or wise action is in the context of a group, in the context of keeping non-harming in mind. But then we come back out into daily life, into everyday life, and we're bombarded with choices. We have all of these choices and decisions to make, and we have to actually claim responsibility for our own integrity. Right? This is quite a thing. So when I read the Mangala Sutta after the sit, I noticed that Lindell read this last week, and I was excited about that. Because this is just one place in which the Buddha really encourages, it's meant to be an empowering teaching. So the Buddha encourages us to kind of take responsibility for our actions, right? Not in like a scolding, punitive way, but recognizing that the source of protection is not going to come from outside often, that we don't have to wait for a deity or a god or someone kind of holier than us to give us blessings or to give us protection, as was kind of the practice prior to the Buddha's time, that actually we can do that through our own intentional actions. We can experience that sense of our minds being protected. We can experience that feeling of being blessed by intentional, deliberate action. So it's meant to be a very practical teaching, but also a deeply empowering one, to kind of put the onus back back on us. The difficulty, and I know probably everyone at Seattle Insight has spoken to this month, is that it's very easy for us to take teachings, like wise action, in which we have five precepts or eight precepts, and take them as kind of commandments or ideals that we're supposed to live up to, and kind of feel frustrated or despondent when we can't live up to them. Kind of this wayward or errant self comes to the fore. So that's not the way the teachings were intended. So I love that last week Lindell mentioned joy. So she mentioned that we can actually take joy and delight in being on this path of considering the effects of our actions. So the wonderful thing about these practices and this path is that when we get it right, we're on the path. When we get it wrong, we're still on the path. We don't get kicked off. But the invitation is to stay sensitive, to stay aware of the effects of our actions, to notice. So we can be, when we kind of step back and frame it in that way, we can kind of delight in the learning. So if we are completely overtaken with regret and remorse and guilt every time we engage in an action that we consider bad or wrong or unskillful, if we are kind of overtaken by guilt and a sense of wrongness and badness, we can't move forward. We're completely stuck. So if we can take all of the noticing with a large kind of grain of salt, sense of humor, then we can continue. Then we can learn. Then we can refine. And that whole process can be joyful. Right. So I think one of the other things I just wanted to highlight is that the way that we engage in right action, it doesn't need to look like anybody else's right action. It can be very unique to the circumstances we find ourselves in, to our capacities in the moment, to the situations and needs that we find around us. So many of us are balancing family lives, social action, bodies with various in various stages of wellness and injury. So our wise action needs to be completely aligned with our own sense of integrity and what's possible. It doesn't need to look like anybody else's. In that way, it's very creative, fluid, and unique. So the Buddha did mention that the kind of framework or basis for wise action is the precepts or the kind of guidelines for ethical action, kind of like the baseline in which we undertake the training. Right? We undertake the training. We don't demand perfection, but we can undertake the training to notice and refrain when we are killing or taking life reflexively. When we're taking that which isn't given, when we're stealing, when we are being harsh or untruthful with our speech, if we're misusing our sexuality, using it in ways that are creating harm, then we're going against that precept. And also if we're taking intoxicants or taking in, consuming things that cloud our mind, cloud our judgment, and lead to heedlessness. So lead to going against our values and our deepest intentions. So we're meant to kind of reflect on these things and notice deeply where we start acting on automatic pilot and where we're acting reflexively and not intentionally. So it's a way of helping move us out of automatic pilot, reflexive action, and into more intentional action. So what I wanted to just mention are just a few kind of reminders or prompts. So before we move into discussion or dialogue around this, a few months ago with my Vashon Sangha, we explored the Lojong teachings, so the slogans of Lojong from the Tibetan tradition. And there are these, there are numerous kind of small pithy sayings that are meant to remind us of kind of teachings or practices that are core. And so we, over several months, went through all, we didn't go through all of them, but there were between 60 and 70 of these slogans or teachings. And that way of practicing has been very, very helpful for me over these last few months. So I thought I'd just offer a few kind of pithy prompts that might help maybe encapsulate some of these teachings as we go forward into daily life. Because as we're in the heat of the moment, maybe some of you have noticed this, but long, complex lists and definitions are not very helpful. You know, when you're in the heat of an argument or when you're feeling caught up in something, very long philosophical teachings are often hard to access. So short, pithy sayings that you can remember, you know, not to oversimplify, but can be very, very helpful. So I'll just mention a few. And these will likely be things that you already know, but hopefully there are things that you can access. So again, to remember that this kind of ethical sensitivity or alignment with our integrity, there is a deep naturalness to it. So sometimes we can get very complicated trying to apply principles on top of maybe a system that is agitated or activated. But the first kind of principle or maybe pithy saying is slowness supports integrity. Slowness supports integrity. So going slowly, an invitation to pause and to slow down will almost always help improve our, help kind of remind and resensitize us to our values and to that sensitivity in terms of what's wholesome and helpful and what isn't. So don't be afraid to go slowly. This is such a basic principle of mindfulness practice. The ability and the capacity to be deliberate and intentional with what we're doing, to not feel like we have to always go at this kind of breakneck speed, and to notice the relationship between that and treating those around us with care and consideration and respect. So my own reflections around ethics and integrity, it's been very sobering to notice when I reflect back on actions that I regret, you know, speech that was not what I intended, it was harmful, or places when I didn't act when in retrospect, I would have liked to have acted or said something in those situations. Oftentimes, it's because I'm moving too fast and some other agenda has overtaken the situation. So I've got to kind of get to the next thing or get the project complete or make sure I meet a deadline or, you know, and these things are all we need to keep in our awareness. But often it's the case that kind of getting to the end or speeding through something to get to the next thing, we lose our sensitivity. It's like trying to stay aware of particulars as we're speeding down the freeway and everything's blurring by in the window. We can't actually discern what's helpful and what's unhelpful if we're always going on to the next thing. What's next? What's next? What's next? I know Tim invited the first week or two invitation to kind of notice the suffering that often is behind a lot of our reflexive, unskillful actions. We can't notice this if we haven't slowed down a little bit, given ourselves the time and space to notice what's actually happening as it's happening. So just notice, how does slowness, how does your pace affect your sense of integrity or alignment? And so going along with this is stay close. So this is something that I learned from puppy training. So I have a 2-year-old puppy. And one of those prompts that we used over and over again in training was stay close, stay close, right? So the puppy in the training process can learn to kind of attune with you and attune to the tug of the leash or attune to your commands, which they can't do if they're following every single impulse to go in every single direction. So it is this kindness to stay close to the effects of your actions. So this is staying intimate with our own experiences and noticing before an action, during an action, after an action, to kind of stay close and feel those effects. Wonderful activist and leader in the nonviolent communication community, Mickey Kashtan, all of these beautiful explorations on what it means to live an ethical life in these times that we find ourselves in. Remember one of her reflections once was deciding early on that she was not going to have a smartphone for a variety of reasons. And just deciding both for the impacts on her own mind, but mostly because knowing that so many of the parts were sourced from places that did not have good ethical practices. So, people in Kenya, using resources and human labor in ways that were creating harm. And so her reflection was, does it make a difference globally if I decide to not purchase this smartphone? Does it make a difference in the wider scheme of things, on the environment, on human suffering? Does it make a difference, just my action to not purchase this phone? She said, in the grand scheme of things, maybe not, probably not. But she said, it keeps me on my toes in terms of noticing and if the effects on my own mind of acting with integrity or not. So it kind of keeps me awake, keeps me close to the effects on my actions. Is this action in alignment or is it not? So being willing to go slow, to stay close, and then to notice that kind of shrug that we can often get into, that I can often get into, in which we're tempted, maybe because of our own speed or because of some other impulse that takes hold. And there's kind of a gesture. Well, this doesn't really matter. I'll just send this email. Don't have time. I'm just going to send the email or blurt out the response. Kind of like a shrug. Well, not too bad. Doesn't really matter. So to just mind that shrug, to notice that. In this poem by William Stafford, won't read the whole thing, but I've used it in contemplation a lot. It's called A Ritual to Read to Each Other. And he talks about a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break. Yeah. In which our kind of belonging to each other or our care for each other, there's a simple shrug that lets that fragile sequence break. So there's the invitation to not become complacent in our actions. There's always the invitation to look clear-eyed, sensitively, clearly, honestly, that recognition that each of our actions matter, each of our actions has an effect that we can discern, that others will feel maybe immediately or down the road, but that all actions have effect. So not to make us paranoid, but not to get complacent either. So there are always these little pockets I notice in myself. And this was true of my early, speaking of retreat experience as well. I would kind of let retreat and meditative environments do the sila or do the ethical action for me. And then afterwards, I would kind of live my life, get stirred up again, get all kind of worked up, and then kind of come back and try to pick up exactly where I left off. But there are no kind of pauses in that way in which we get to not be part of cause and effect, you know, where we get to just kind of have a pass for a while and then kind of pick back up again. So to kind of mind the shrug or notice those places in which maybe we've gotten a little complacent. A wonderful kind of antidote for that complacency is being in community. So maybe you've noticed that often we're getting feedback from those around us about our actions. So another prompt is to kind of be interested in feedback. So this is very difficult to do. One of my dear teaching friends, Matthew Brensilver, talks about how our ability to skillfully receive feedback. People are coming to us with feedback about the effects of our actions, you know, not just trolling us online, giving us insults, but coming to us with feedback, people of integrity who we're connected to. So Matthew's comment was, our ability to receive feedback is kind of like a stress test for the sense of self. All right? So the degree to which we contract and reject and get defensive around feedback, that is a place where we're very identified with whatever we're doing, where the sense of self is very strong and solid. So if we're interested in the feedback, then we're back to that kind of learning again. We're back on the path. We're back to being able to use the information to steer our own action again. Okay. So the last one I just wanted to mention, hopefully these are again just reminders of things that you already know, but at the essence of all of our kind of teachings on ethics and practices, it is to deeply remember that the humanity inside me and the humanity inside everyone else is connected and similar. So that is the heart of all of the ethical practices, perhaps all of the practices that we do. It's to remember that core of our humanity. Right? So again, kind of coming back to fundamentals and basics. When I was with I worked for a long time with mostly elderly people at the end of their lives, in which there weren't a lot of other kind of cures or solutions for the conditions that they had, right? So they were often actively dying. I often think about this when I'm reflecting on what to teach, because it would have been very inappropriate for me to offer a very detailed Buddhist list or very kind of refined philosophical teachings, a treatise on Buddhism. And ethics not have been helpful in that situation with somebody who's actively dying. But remembering my own embodiment, my own capacity to slow down and be sensitive to the effects of what I'm saying, thinking, and doing inside and outside, Yes, to staying close to those, to being responsive to the needs and kind of heart minds of those around me, and to remember that kind of core humanity, despite maybe a lot of challenging behavior or failing body, that core humanity. Those were all things that were extremely skillful and that we can remember and come back to as we're engaged with people in the world. So this is what it means to kind of be a contemplative, to take the circumstances that we find ourselves in and to, we can think about these circumstances, certainly reflect on them in a skillful way. That's very helpful. Am I causing harm in this situation? Am I contributing into a situation but causing harm to myself? Now, these are where the questions get very interesting. So many of us have a lot of natural tendencies towards generosity and giving and kind of contributing, but we can also have a bit of the identity around being sort of a martyr. My well-being doesn't matter. It's the well-being of everybody else around me. So I'll kind of go down with the ship, but still be, you know, contributing. That's not the teaching. That's not the teaching. The teaching is to find actions, ways of engaging that benefit both myself and others, right? That are in touch with kind of my own humanity and the other, not one at the exclusion of the other. So that's kind of a refrain that comes up again and again. So we tend to break the precepts when we forget, yeah? When we forget our own humanity, the humanity of the other. Right? So Fred Rogers, I always think about this when I'm thinking about ethics, said, "I never eat anything that has a mother." Yeah? I never eat anything that has a mother. And just thinking about the exquisite ways in which our humanity is tied to one another, it is so motivating to kind of remember the human, but also remember the beingness of one another. So not to bring everything back to the dog, but the puppy, the other night we were watching a documentary on dogs and the minds of dogs. And this is not going to be too much of an aside, but the way in which their facial features, the muscles in their faces have evolved particular ways of contracting and releasing their eyebrows and affecting their gaze so that humans will relate, connect, and respond to them with care. Right? So that's how attuned we are to the creatures around us. Right? So when the dog is giving me puppy eyes as I'm leaving the house and going to be away for several hours, I have an effect. That has an effect on me. I'm, almost, wired to respond. So our ethical qualities and capacities are deeply relational. Yeah. The ways that we're attuned to the well-being of each other, one another, are deeply relational. We're wired for fighting, for fleeing, but we're also deeply wired for connection and care. So this last reminder to remember the shared beingness is kind of at the heart of the whole matter. Okay, the last bit, very last prompt, is to plant seeds, water, and let go. Plant seeds, water, and let go. This is the gardening metaphor that's used again and again in practice. Whereas oftentimes we're engaging in intentional, skillful actions, but then at the very end we slip in there and we really, really want the certain result that we think should happen. Yeah? We want our project to be successful. We want other people to recognize us for the generous action we've performed. We want our wholesome action to be received in the way that we think it should be received, right? So it's the hardest thing in the world to kind of plant seeds, water, and then let go, leave the rest to nature, let go of the result. We don't know when the seeds that we're planting now are going to sprout. We don't know when the actions that we're setting in motion now are going to have effects. Sometimes we can feel the effects, sometimes we can't. But there's a lot more alignment with those natural causes and conditions that we know will lead in a certain direction. So it's to not waste our time kind of lamenting the carrots that didn't grow or screaming at the carrots to grow faster or anything like that. For those of you who practiced at IMS in Massachusetts, I had the great fortune of being there over a couple of springs, over a few years, and there's this wonderful magnolia tree near one of the buildings. And I noticed, because I would come day after day after day over as the season was changing, and this magnolia tree was full of all of these different kinds of blossoms, like full blossoms that were just completely abundant and open and radiant and beautiful, and others that would just kind of stay in a bud the whole time, others that would start to decay like halfway through. So I think a lot of where we get stuck around ethical action is that we don't trust that the seeds that we're planting, not everything comes into full recognizable bloom in the way that we think it should. Yeah. But it does have an effect, always has an effect. Okay, so I hope some of these prompts are helpful. We can notice how our speed affects our integrity. Yeah. We can stay close. We can remember the shrug, yeah, to be aware of the shrug. We can take the feedback, be open to the feedback. Remember the human or the being, and then trust in the seeds. Trust in the seeds. Okay, let's just sit quietly for a moment. And just again, coming back to your own experience in this moment without expectation. This willingness to notice and look, to stay sensitive and interested, that in itself is wholesome. Thank you for your attention tonight. Thank you for your practice. Have a hard time with recaps because I get excited. So I hope some of this is useful. It's hard to stay simple. Yeah, that's part of the slowness practice. Hard to stay simple sometimes. Takes quite a bit of restraint. But I'd love to hear a little bit from you. What have you noticed this month? What's been interesting? What's been challenging? Anything?
Thank you for the talk, Carrie. It's been really interesting thinking about right action all month. I had this experience of it in the last few days, where we have this bird feeder on our back deck. We're quite near a green space and just get all this wonderful, wonderful variety of birds that come all the time. I just love sitting out there and seeing them all, so many different birds, and you know, they scatter seed all over the deck underneath, so I'm always sweeping up the seed, and birds are coming and scavenging the bottom. A week or two ago, I started noticing a rat that was coming that also scavenged the seeds. We've had experiences with rats getting into the house, big problem and big issue to try and resolve, and did not want that to happen again. Like I've done in the past, set a trap, caught the rat, killed the rat, got rid of the rat. And then I was sitting with it, something I've never done before, but going through this right action, I was sitting and realizing this feels really careless in relation to the precepts. Felt very careless to me, something I just never thought of. Now, look, I'm not a vegetarian, but like this is an instance in which I sort of invited this wildness into my space. And then I'm trying to pick and choose what life I feel really good about inviting that wildness in. And then, you know, disposing of that wildness that I don't want to be in. And that was and with that realization was just very sobering to think about, you know, what is my relationship to my action in that circumstance? How am I being thoughtful about life in that regard? It's one thing for me to choose, I'm going to eat this meat. It's another thing that, because I want to look at the birds, I'm going to kill the rats that show up. But certainly not something I think I'd ever contemplated before this month's right action thought.
Oh,
so
great.
Anyway.
Great. Yeah. I mean, what you're describing there is, first it took kind of a deliberate, like slowing down so that you could sense into the situation, whereas before it may have been more reflexive. But there's just so much more nuance often to these decisions. So we have to be able to kind of tolerate that. I mean, some of us would just, you know, often, many of us or some, all of us at certain times, it's hard to kind of hang out in that nuance. A lot of these questions there are gray areas. It's not a matter of harm on one side, no harm on the other side, but how can I minimize harm? Yeah, and so it kind of reveals what's happening internally, but also it opens up a greater kind of creativity of response that is really wholesome, but often not immediate. So I appreciate you saying that, because I could hear your kind of deliberate willingness to reflect and kind of look at it a different way. What is going on here? what's actually happening. So it's the precepts are also mindfulness trainings. It's not separate from mindfulness. Yeah, great. Thank you. Really appreciate that. Yeah, thanks.
Something in what you said really resonated with what I wanted, with something that I this idea of inviting the wildness in, but then kind of trying to pick and choose about what wildness comes out resonates for me on a different level of kind of how I treat myself. And I've been noticing like a lot of work with rigidity and control versus kind of allowing and how rigid I want to be. I think in my practice in my life, I've seen a lot of rigidity and control and very strict rules. So it's been very interesting to work with where is loosening up actually the practice.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like I'm at like a really clear answer around that or like one pithy example. Like there's a lot of small examples where like I've been staying out a lot later in the past like months, week than I had before. And I had really specific rules about like, I need to get X amount of sleep because that'll make me the most mindful and I need to sit in the morning in a specific way. And I actually think that that's been a really good practice for me to like try. Yeah, try embracing what life has instead of assuming I know what the rules are to the game.
Yeah, great.
So, yeah, that's been my experience working with it in the past month, a couple months.
That's great. Thanks for being willing to share about that. And I can hear in that too, you know, other factors of the Eightfold Path coming in there too, like at what you're speaking to, I think also is elements of right effort or wise effort in which we're experimenting with not too tight but not too loose, and noticing places in which we're really gripping on to control and what that feels like and the effects of doing that. And then if we can, you know, loosen a little bit and trust that there's another kind of sensitivity or relationship to what's happening that isn't based on control, but that can still go in a helpful and healthy direction. So that balance between kind of hands up, there's nothing I can do, let's just, you know, whatever, the shrug, and then just like gripping onto a result. So right in between is this like fluid, dynamic unknown, right? Where that's what our practice leads us towards, is that exploring that area of unknown. Sounds like what you described also. So, and I love the, just what you were, I don't know if you were connecting this to the precepts or not, but for those of us who are very conditioned, you know, especially many of us conditioned as female, to be kind of good in a certain way. And probably does not follow along gender lines, but different aspects of it. And we kind of have to decondition some of that in practice to like really see where we're kind of motivated by this deeply conditioned desire to be kind of seen as good, or to think of ourselves as good, and to maybe detach from rules that we're, you know, that we've relied on for some kind of structure or control. Yeah. So, and trust that we can explore and experiment and stay close to our own experience. And that gives us confidence, I think, that we don't need as many rules to keep ourselves in line. That we can, yeah. Anyway, I could keep going, but thank you for your reflection. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you too.
Thank you. Yeah, maybe one more here, and then I'll see if anyone online.
I appreciate you bringing up that right action is not just right action towards others,
yeah,
but towards ourself.
Yeah.
That's been something that's been very challenging. And in my practice of reflecting on past actions that I thought were right actions and turned out poorly, that many times it was a lack of attunement to my own needs,
right,
and a lack of self-compassion.
Right.
And as that develops more and more, sitting with that discomfort of, this isn't okay for me.
Right.
Because it's a very, as you said, with conditioning, it's a very uncomfortable place, mm-hmm, to say, this isn't okay for me.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes much easier. It's still really hard to that discernment between what is right action for you and what is right action for me, and where is the middle ground in that. It's a hard place to find, but it's nice to find it sometimes.
That's right. That's right. And it gets, I think that gets a little more natural and easy with practice. And the feeling, you know, often when we're cultivating a wholesome quality like generosity or kindness, it's so clear that it's benefiting ourselves as well as the other. Like it's so clear. So if there's a sense that we're deeply harming ourselves at the expense of kind of some idea of being generous or kind, that's a good place to pause. Yeah, it's a really good place to pause. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah.
Hi. I think another part of reaction that's maybe not so often talked about is making the most out of opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And there's many times where I feel like my intention was good and I was very careful the whole time, but out of some kind of clumsiness or some kind of problem with my thinking, I wasn't able to make the most out of whatever opportunity came my way.
Mm.
And so I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for overcoming this kind of wrong action.
Mm. Mm. It seems like you're, as in your process of reflecting something that you might, sounds like, have some regret around, noticing in which maybe there was a way in which you were well-intentioned, but kind of didn't stay available. You know, the Buddha has this beautiful teaching to his son, in which he's encouraging his son to stay aware of actions, kind of before he does them, during, and then after, you know. So it's not just like you set the intention and then, all right, well, I'm well intentioned, and then you can do whatever. But you're kind of staying attuned, staying aware before, during, and after. And so maybe, I don't know the situation you're referring to, but maybe there was a lot of awareness in the beginning, but then it kind of waned a little bit. So maybe you missed an opportunity to follow up. So I think the key part there, or maybe to take advantage of an opportunity, to use your words, but maybe the learning there is, so rather than going into any kind of self-recrimination or discouragement, or it can easily go in that direction, but to say, oh, okay, to kind of notice and invite the awareness to kind of stay longer, you know, to notice that more of that after, and to stay available, open. You know, we're not gonna, just like we're not always gonna get right action exactly right, we're not always gonna get every opportunity either, but we can endeavor to stay kind of aware and open to possibilities. You know? Feels like when we're fully in the present moment, kind of aware, connected with our intention and our view, we're much more aware of possibilities. You know, it's kind of that creativity. It's like we see things that we may not have been able to foresee or strategize before. It's like, oh, there's that possibility and that connection. So we can't control that or make that happen, but we can kind of plant that seed of staying open to possibilities and being available for them when they arise. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. Thanks for being the talk show host, Adam.
Thank you, Carrie. Within the last several weeks, I had an incident where I felt and I did some unwholesome action. And then I was caught in it. So that's what shocked me to reality. And what I realized in thinking about it, because I had to sit with what I had done, then I realized that I wasn't in the present at that time.
Yeah.
I wasn't present. I wasn't listening. And so, and also staying with that, I had to confront myself, because it made me feel terrible after that. I really felt terrible and a lot of anxiousness and what do I do? So I had to think about it. And I had to summon up the courage to speak to the person and apologize. And actually the person said, oh, don't worry, it was just a blip. But still, I had gone through that period of dukkha where I wasn't. So it also made me think about how important the four foundations of mindfulness are. And to, you know, going back to our, you know, the staple or the foundations of how we began in our meditation practice, you know, foundation of our bodies and our minds and the object and the Dharma. Mm-hmm. So that was a revelation for me. And yeah. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. And that kind of like agitation that you felt afterwards, you know, in the Buddhist teachings, like, that's a good sign. That's good. Those qualities are the guardians, right? Our conscience and our concern. That conscience that actually we feel kind of agitated when we do something that is out of alignment with our values, and we may be really concerned about the effects in the future. That's a good sign of practice, and that develops right along with mindful awareness, you know. So, you know, what I was trying to point to in the beginning, that it comes, that sensitivity comes. So that's not like you've strayed from the path. That's part of the path. That's how that sensitivity deepens. We learn to trust it more. Those situations, not that they stop happening, but they become maybe a little bit simpler, you know? They're not so destabilizing. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, thank you. All right. Thank you, everybody. We move towards a close. Really appreciate the reflections, and I hope they continue. So, as we've probably said in numerous ways, the factors all support each other. So it's not like we graduate from one and then move to the next. They're often weaving together. So tonight, mindfulness effort intention, view, they're all part of the momentum of walking the path. Okay, let's just take one minute to offer the merit if we can. So no need to change your posture, do anything fancy, but simply just incline your mind. Form the intention in your own way that the benefits of our practice be shared. So whatever understanding or calm or inspiration, insight you may have experienced, may it be of great benefit to you and to all those you come in contact with. So may our practice be of benefit to ourselves and all beings everywhere, without exception. Everybody go well.